I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The nation is focused on yesterday's tragic and horrifying school shooting in Texas, our topic for tomorrow's Radio Times when we have more information. Today, we want to focus on another tragedy. As of earlier this month, 1 million Americans have died from COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic. That's a million funerals and millions of people grieving the loss of a family member, a loved one, a friend, a colleague who died from the virus. While infection and hospitalization rates have been spiking in the last few months, death rates have remained relatively low, largely because of vaccines and better treatments. But we're dealing with a crafty and adaptable virus, and just 66.5% of the population that is fully vaccinated against COVID, and a lesser percent that's gotten a booster. Coming up, we'll talk about what you need to know about living with COVID. But first, a few questions about monkeypox that's been getting a lot of coverage. Let me introduce our two guests. Dr. Celine Gounder is editor-at-large for public health at Kaiser Health News. She's an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine and Bellevue Hospital. Dr. Gounder, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
And also with us and joining us by Skype is Dr. Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada. And Dr. Rasmussen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much for having me, Marty.
Well, let's talk about monkeypox. I don't want to spend the full hour on it, but it's so much in the news, and I think people just have some very basic questions about it. And Dr. Rasmussen, I'll begin with you. What is unique about the monkeypox virus?
So monkeypox is unique in the sense that, well, all viruses are unique. It's its own virus, but it's also much different than SARS coronavirus 2. And I think that a lot of people have been trying to understand it through the lens of COVID. And it really should not be. So it is an orthopox virus. It's more related to the smallpox virus, which, of course, has been eradicated in nature for 40 years. It typically causes less severe disease than smallpox, which is good news. And it's actually transmitted very differently. It's a very different type of virus in terms of its biology. So we really should be thinking of it as its own virus, separate from COVID. We should be understanding it for what it is, the dangers that it presents, and importantly also the dangers that it doesn't present. I think that it's very unlikely that monkeypox, even if it causes a large epidemic, is actually going to cause a sustained pandemic that we're going to be dealing with for months to come.
What is the transmission rate, or how is it transmitted?
So monkeypox is transmitted. It can be transmitted by inhalation of aerosols, but that's not thought to be the primary method of transmission. The primary mode of transmission is actually direct contact transmission or indirect contact transmission. So those vesicles in the vesicular rash that many people have seen pictures of that you know, looks pretty unpleasant, those pustules are actually full of virus. So if you are touching somebody, if you're physically touching skin-to-skin contact or touching clothing or bedding that they've recently been wearing or in contact with, then that exposes you to a fairly large dose of virus, and that can cause transmission from person to person.
And Dr. Gander, do we know how contagious it is?
Monkeypox is not nearly as contagious as viruses like SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID, or measles. It really does require much closer contact. And so unless you're having that kind of close contact with somebody where you have that skin-to-skin contact, it's one of the reasons we think that we are seeing clusters of cases among men who have sex with men. If you think about it, sex is a form of very close skin-to-skin mm-hmm. contact. But it really requires that level of contact to see transmission.
And what about treatment? Let's say someone gets it. And my understanding is that there may be a handful of cases in the U.S. Do I have that right, Dr. Gounder?
Yeah, that's right, including at my own hospital, Bellevue Hospital. There's a patient under investigation there. There are no proven treatments for monkeypox, but we do have a vaccine that is effective against both smallpox and monkeypox. The old vaccines we used to use for smallpox, that we used to eradicate smallpox, are not what we are using today. We actually have newer, safer vaccines that would prevent both monkeypox as well as smallpox. And what you may see is what we call a ring vaccination strategy, which again was also used for smallpox. where you vaccinate the close contacts of a case with the vaccine. You don't vaccinate the general public.
Right, right. And to you, Dr. Rasmussen, I was reading about what if someone were to come in contact, that it's a matter of, what, 2 to 4 weeks of isolation, sort of staying away from other people. Is that the best approach?
Yeah, so that's correct. So monkeypox actually has a fairly long incubation period. Another key difference between monkeypox and SARS coronavirus 2 is that monkeypox isn't really spread presymptomatically. Right. So during that long incubation time, you could come down with what's called the prodromal phase, which is essentially sort of vague flu-like symptoms before you develop a visible rash. And that is the point where you can become contagious to another person. So during this, you know, 7 to 14, all the way up to 21-day period where you're in the incubation phase, you could develop this prodromal phase or develop the rash at any time. And that's the point where you pose a transmission risk to somebody else. So if somebody is a contact, they do need to quarantine for that full isolation or for that full incubation period to make sure that they aren't going to become a transmission risk to other people around them.
And what is the appropriate coverage for this? And I asked that. We were going back and forth. How much time should we spend during this, you know, 1 hour of Radio Times? You know, how much time should we spend talking about monkeypox? Let me toss that back to you, Dr. Rasmussen.
Well, I think that it is important to cover it because, you know, in the course of the last couple of years, people have become obviously much more attuned to the world of emerging viruses. And when people hear that, you know, there's this pox virus that is related to smallpox, which everybody I think knows is bad, but many people actually didn't live through, you know, that's spreading now and that's emerged in unexpected places and that's spreading, you know, more across more countries than it ever has before. That's big news, and I think that's really concerning and scary to a lot of people. And it is concerning from a public health perspective. We know that these emerging viruses are going to continue to emerge. I think it is really important, though, to put that in the proper context for the public so that they know what steps to take to protect themselves, and also so that they understand that right now the risk remains getting exposed to SARS coronavirus 2 for the vast majority of people and not monkeypox. So they do need to understand that this is a concern from a global health perspective, but this is not necessarily going to be a concern for them from an individual person perspective. It is something they know about, though, and so people really should be getting the reliable information that can help them put it into the proper context.
Dr. Gander, anything you want to add before we move on to COVID?
I would 100% agree with everything Angela just said. And what I would say is if I were a member of the general public, I would not be that concerned about monkeypox as a threat to myself. But it is another sign that we do need to have robust public health systems and surveillance systems.
Well, let me talk about the fact that a million people have died of COVID-19, probably more than that when you actually add up the actual numbers of cases. But as I understand it, that's more than the numbers of people who died from the pandemic of 1918-1919, the third leading cause of death now after heart disease and cancer. And we actually saw the largest drop in life expectancy since World War II. Dr. Gander, if I can go back to you, I just want to pause on that and sort of digest what it is that we have been through in the last 2 years. Can you speak to that?
If you had asked me at the beginning of the pandemic that a million people would die from COVID in this country, I would not have believed you. And it is really startling to look at the numbers and also startling to see what disparities have emerged over the course of the pandemic. It was really interesting. In the early days, people said to me, oh, this is going to be the great leveler, the great equalizer. We're all at risk. And that is not how this has played out. Something like 3/4 of deaths have been among the elderly. We have seen dramatic disparities between white populations and people of color. And this is really a reflection of who we prioritize with respect to health care and public health in this country.
As you say, this has all been exposed. Do you have confidence that we will use this information to try to create a better public health system?
I wish I could say I had that confidence. Unfortunately, the pattern in public health is a boom and bust cycle where you have a lot of attention a lot of interest during a crisis, and then that rapidly fades. And we're not even out of this pandemic. We're not even out of the real crisis. And the political desire to do something about this, to improve public health, to fund public health, to fund the COVID response has already evaporated.
Dr. Rasmussen, anything you want to add to that?
I completely agree with that. You know, this is the point that I've been making over and over again recently, is that it really is a boom and bust cycle. And that is what's gotten us into this problem in the first place. The fact is, we react to things, including emerging diseases. We don't proactively prepare for them. If we want to be ready for the next time something like this happens, and I think monkeypox is a great example of how we can expect viruses to emerge, to varying degrees, of course, of how many people they're impacting. If we really want to be prepared for that, if we want to prevent that, we need to invest sustained efforts into preparing for that and not just wait around for something to emerge and then respond to it, usually ineffectively.
Well, I'm thinking of 2 years ago and to today, and I'll go back to you, Dr. Rasmussen. I mean, we do have vaccines. Not everyone has them. We have boosters. Most people haven't gotten a booster. But are we in a better place today to deal with COVID, even these variants, than we were 2 years ago?
I mean, no question we're in a better place. But I would just say, at what cost are we in that better place? You know, as you pointed out, we do have vaccines. The vaccines have been incredible. We do have vaccine doses available for boosters. It would be nice if we certainly had variant-specific boosters. But we have come a long way. And even though it's not the way that I would prefer us to get to population immunity, many people at this point have survived a SARS coronavirus 2 infection. And so there is some residual immunity from that as well. As a population, we're obviously in a better place than we were 2.5 years ago. But again, at what cost did we get there? We could do this in a way that doesn't cost a million lives plus. We could do this in a way that doesn't cost millions more in terms of loss and disability. But we have chosen not to do that. And my big fear is that we're going to make this choice all over again for the viruses that are yet to come.
We're almost having a break here. Then what should we be doing?
So we really should be investing in ways to get ahead of the next pandemic. And that means really investing in all levels of our healthcare and our pandemic preparedness system. It means investing in basic research to prepare in terms of developing new vaccines, new antiviral drugs proactively. So things like pan-coronavirus vaccines, some of that work is ongoing. But pan-vaccines, universal vaccines that will target multiple pathogens within a given family of viruses, including viruses that we may not even know exist yet. It also means shoring up our healthcare system. It means investing in healthcare that more people can access. And as Celine pointed out, there have been tremendous disparities. So it means putting a lot of money into trying to equalize those disparities and try to provide some healthcare for people who don't have access to it, make sure that access is equitable and just.
Well, we got to keep it.
That's really what we need to do.
And a very short break. We'll be right back to our conversation. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. We're getting an update on COVID-19, talking with Celine Gounder, editor-at-large for public health at Kaiser Health News. She's an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist. Also with us, Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. That, of course, is in Canada. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. Any questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Too much multitasking here. Let me go back to you, Dr. Gounder. And I said in my introduction, I Googled this yesterday just to make sure that I was pretty close to correct. 66.5% of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated. About 46% have gotten one booster. If we had population herd immunity, what would those numbers look like?
I don't think we're ever going to get to herd immunity with SARS-CoV-2, and that's for a couple different reasons. One, it is such a highly infectious virus, and two, it has an extremely short incubation period. And so even if you have underlying immunity against severe disease, hospitalization, and death, if you're relying on your memory immune response, so after you're beyond that short window of 3 to 4 months after, say, a booster shot or an infection, you are relying on that memory at that point. And your memory immune response doesn't kick in that quickly to beat that very short incubation period of the virus. So the virus does have an opportunity to take hold, to infect, even if you are protected against severe disease.
So if the disease is here with us, do we have to learn to live with masks, with distancing, or is it finding new technologies, in a sense, that can help from a medical point of view keep us safer, Dr. Gounder?
Well, we have to target both the infection and transmission, which vaccines are not as good at doing, as well as preventing the severe medical consequences, which vaccines are excellent at doing. In terms of preventing transmission, yes, it might mean making more use of masks, particularly certain times of year or in certain settings. And there are other technologies, tools that we really have not scaled up to improve indoor air quality. So ventilation, air filtration, UV germicidal irradiation, these are tools that, if scaled up, could really reduce the risk in indoor settings and also protect against a whole host of other infections, allergens that might trigger asthma and the like.
Are you talking about, you know, in schools and in restaurants? I mean, sort of basic architecture that we live with, that we just need better ventilation all the way around?
That's exactly right. And we take for granted today that we turn on our kitchen sink and the water is clean. It's drinkable. That would not have been the case, over 100 years ago. And I think we need to reassess what our standards should be for indoor air quality.
Dr. Esselman, let me go back to you, because we're seeing this spiking of cases of people getting infected with COVID. And a number of those people are fully vaccinated. I frankly know a couple of these people that have gotten COVID in the last couple of weeks who took all the steps to try to protect themselves. What is going on here?
Well, I think what's going on here is a couple different things. So for one thing, our vaccines are, again, excellent. They're still providing excellent protection, in some cases against infection, too. But if you are fully vaccinated, these vaccines are designed against the ancestral strains of SARS coronavirus 2 from essentially 2 years ago that are no longer circulating. And they are designed to target the spike protein of SARS coronavirus 2, and the spike protein of Omicron, of all the different Omicron sublineages, is actually quite different from that original SARS coronavirus 2 spike protein. So that means that a lot of the antibodies that were raised against the ancestral spike protein by the vaccines are not necessarily going to actually work to neutralize the spike protein of the Omicron sublineages that are circulating now. So that means that essentially you can still have these robust long-term immune responses. And as Celine said, this does rely on your immune system's essentially memory recall, but it's going to be recalling an antigen or a virus that is not circulating and that is not what people are being exposed to. So that's why people who are fully vaccinated are still getting infected with the viruses that are circulating now.
And the people that are getting COVID now with this new variant, are they then getting at least some immunity for this current variant?
Well, so this is something that I think is a very active area of research, but some preliminary data does seem to suggest that in people who are fully vaccinated, who get infected with at least BA1, they do have essentially a broadening of their immune response to include the spike antigens and the other viral antigens that are from the Omicron lineage that they're being infected with. So this is essentially what people are referring to as hybrid immunity. It's effectively acting like a booster that does sort of broaden the immune response. Now, what we don't know is how effective that is at preventing future infections with variants of the Omicron family, and also how long that broadened protection might last.
Do you, Dr. Gounder, can we assume that we have all been exposed to some form of COVID?
I would say not necessarily. If you look at the CDC data, yes, a very large proportion of the population, particularly kids, who have not many kids have not been vaccinated or have only been vaccinated recently, a large proportion of the population has been exposed. But not everyone, I can say for myself, working at Bellevue Hospital during the peak of the pandemic, wearing my N95 mask successfully protected me, and I have yet to get COVID. So these other layers of protection do work.
Well, let me pick up on masks because, for instance, here in Philadelphia, because of the increase in number of cases, school children now are required to wear masks. I believe that's true for some other school districts here in the Philadelphia area. It gets confusing. I just sort of walk around with a mask under my chin, sort of depending on, you know, what I am doing that particular day. But do we need a kind of one-size-fits-all messaging about mask wearing?
I think the message should be that masks are a basic hygienic measure, just like toilet paper. We don't politicize use of toilet paper. We shouldn't politicize the use of masks. And there are times of year, just like on the weather report, they say it's going to be a rainy day. You choose to take an umbrella with you. We should have similar kind of messaging that we have very high rates of virus transmission in the community, like now, and that this would be a time to that you are strongly recommended to wear a mask when you're indoors.
I take the train and I'd say about half of the people are masked, half are unmasked. It's young people with masks and old people not, and sometimes it's the reverse of that. Is there though some kind of messaging that would at least make sense to everybody, or do we just have our own discretion and then we can decide for ourselves, Dr. Gounder?
Unfortunately, in this country, we are a country where people want to individualize how they approach these health issues. Mm-hmm. There is not going to be a one-size-fits-all. Some people are going to have higher risk based on their occupations, based on their underlying medical conditions. I think all we can really do at this stage where there is relatively low appetite for reinstituting mandates is really to communicate very clearly when the risk is high, that masks work, and when people are strongly recommended to wear a mask.
So Dr. Rasmussen, sort of like, as Dr. Gounder was saying, kind of like the weather report, you know, today you should wear a mask because X, Y, and Z?
I mean, honestly, I don't think that's a bad idea. And I think that practically that might be the only kind of thing that's going to actually be implementable. Right now, there's clearly no political appetite to start reestablishing mask mandates. And I think the public is not going to respond well to that. The public probably would just largely ignore mask mandates in many places, as they have throughout the pandemic. I think it's really even kind of worse now, where a lot of people have, for better or for worse, just kind of moved on, and they're done essentially doing things with COVID. So I think that the best thing to do is to treat it like something like toilet paper, make it very apolitical, but say, you know, here's a suggestion. You might want to think about doing this the same way that you would, you know, you bring an umbrella to work on a day that it's going to rain, or the same way that you would, you know, maybe layer if the weather is going to be unpredictable. I'm like Celine. I have been applying those other measures on top of my full vaccination and boosters, and I also have not gotten COVID. These measures do actually work. So by telling people, you know, now would be a good time to consider applying some of those additional measures, might be a way to actually get people to voluntarily do it, because ultimately I don't think anybody actually wants to get COVID.
Absolutely. Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. Celine Gounder, editor-at-large for public health at Kaiser Health News. She's an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist. And we are talking, yes, about COVID. To be honest with you, it's been a couple of weeks here on Radio Times, but it felt like the time was right to begin to talk once again about COVID because we see certainly transmission rates going up. And again, you can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Dr. Gander, let me go back to you. I was reading that currently the estimate is that there's something like 100,000 new cases every day of COVID. Do I have that right? In the U.S.?
Yeah, that's about right. And that's probably a huge underestimate. I think you have many people who are not getting tested. They might be saying to themselves, might be in a bit of denial, saying to themselves that, oh, those are just seasonal allergies, or I have some other kind of cold. You also have a lot of people who are doing at-home rapid testing, which is great. You know, I think it's a really important tool for people to have the power to diagnose themselves at home. But those tests are not reported to local health departments or to the CDC, so don't make it into those official case counts.
And so what do you think the actual number is if it's not 100,000 a day?
I would be very reluctant to give you a precise estimate. I think it would be the under-reporting is going to vary geographically.
And to you, Dr. Rasmussen, I was reading something like 3,000 people a day are being hospitalized for COVID or some, I guess, some form of COVID. Is that right?
I think that sounds right to me. I mean, it's going to vary from location to location and from region to region in the U.S., but that does sound right. I mean, fortunately, not as many people are actually dying as an outcome. But, you know, certainly being hospitalized is not a mild outcome. It certainly can really profoundly impact your life. And it is certainly more than what we would see during a typical, for example, flu season.
You're in Canada. Do those numbers compare, you know, in where you are today?
So in Saskatchewan, yes, and it's a much different situation here because our healthcare system obviously is very different. We have different capacities, and it's especially been a problem throughout the pandemic in some of the more rural parts of my province and some of the other provinces. There are places, large geographic areas in Canada, where there simply are no hospitals. Yeah. And so having even a few cases there can rapidly become overwhelming for the healthcare system. We do certainly we are having a surge right now in Saskatchewan, as well as in many other Canadian provinces here. As with the U.S., it's not resulting in as many hospitalizations or as many deaths as it was before. But anytime you have a large surge where you have a lot of cases, even a smaller relative proportion of those cases having serious disease is potentially going to become a very difficult situation for any healthcare system to manage, even if it's a large healthcare system such as the one they have in Toronto or in parts of Ontario. So in many ways, it is similar to the U.S., where we still have many more cases than we should, and it's still creating a burden on the healthcare system that we really should not regard as acceptable.
And I'm curious, Dr. Gander, for those people who are testing positive, are these the unvaccinated? Are they the elderly? Are they the people with other health conditions that put them at risk?
Well, certainly people who are unvaccinated remain at highest risk for COVID, as well as the elderly. And elderly people, even if they have been vaccinated, do still have risk. And so especially for that population, getting boosted, layering these other protections remains really important.
And is that just because elderly people, their systems just can't fight quite as hard?
Well, right. Just as your bones and your muscles get weaker as you age, your immune system also ages. It's a phenomenon we call immunosenescence. So your immune system doesn't respond as well, doesn't develop immunity as well. And then you're also more likely to have underlying medical conditions like high blood pressure, diabetes, and so on, that put you at higher risk for severe COVID.
Here's a question from Jennifer. I'll put this to you, Dr. Rasmussen. She says, how well do home antigen tests work on the current Omicron variant?
So that's something that actually is going to vary from antigen test to antigen tests. And unfortunately, most of them are actually proprietary. So it's very difficult to sort of make a ballpark But what's good news is that all of the rapid antigen tests detect the N protein, or the nucleocapsid protein, of SARS coronavirus 2. And in the current variants that are circulating, the N protein is not as different as the spike protein compared to the prior variants that were circulating that it was designed against. So that means that the rapid antigen tests are still really going to probably work in most cases. And certainly there's lots and lots of anecdotal data that suggests that the rapid antigen tests are having no problem detecting Omicron and all of its various sublineages, which are the viruses that are currently circulating right now.
And here's a question from Mike. I'll put this back to you, Angela Rasmussen. And he says, I read that Pfizer has found that the mRNA vaccines don't create the same robust antibodies that your body makes on its own when it fights COVID infection. Can you explain this?
Yeah, so that's not exactly true. The mRNA vaccines, both Pfizer and Moderna, do induce very potent neutralizing antibodies. The problem is that, as I mentioned earlier, these vaccines right now are designed against viruses that no longer are circulating.
Right.
So they're not going to induce really robust antibodies against Omicron because they're not designed to target Omicron. They also are going to induce fewer antibodies, for example, against the N protein and other viral proteins, because they only encode the spike protein. So they're only going to induce an antibody response for the spike protein. So an infection will actually induce a broader antibody response. The only difference, though, is that a lot of the other antibody responses to some of the viral proteins you encounter during infection are less likely to be what's called neutralizing, meaning that they are going to bind the virus and they're going to render it non-infectious. So it really isn't entirely true that the vaccines aren't inducing as robust of antibody responses as infection. Certainly, having an exposure from a vaccine versus an infection is actually potentially a lot better for you in terms of your memory immune system, because you don't have the virus basically screwing around with your immune system while your immune system is learning about it and learning how to target it.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation, yet another conversation about COVID and where things stand today. Talking with Angela Rasmussen and Celine Gounder, and with you. And again, you can always email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call our phone number. It's 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking about how to, frankly, live with COVID. I'm sure many of you were asking, will we ever be free of COVID-19? Probably sick and tired of living under the threat of this rather crafty and nasty virus. And again, talking with Dr. Angela Rasmussen, she's a virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. Dr. Celine Gounder, editor-at-large for public health at Kaiser Health News, and she is an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist. Well, let me talk about children. And I saw in the news that Pfizer-BioNTech said that a three-dose regimen is giving a strong immune response for children. I guess it's under 5 years old. And I wonder, perhaps I'll toss that to you, Dr. Gounder. What do we need to know?
The FDA has scheduled a date in mid-June to review the data from Pfizer and Moderna for their vaccines in kids under five. Based on what we know so far, these vaccines do appear to be very safe, very effective in that age group. And I think parents of kids under the age of five can look forward to finally getting their kids vaccinated probably towards the end of June or in July.
Because, Dr. Rasmussen, this is a very vulnerable population since they have never had a chance to have a vaccine.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, viruses don't have thoughts or feelings or goals. viruses are essentially programmed to make more viruses, and they're going to follow the path of least resistance into the populations that are the most vulnerable. So it really is key that we get as many people vaccinated as possible, and that does include children under the age of 5, because that's exactly who the virus is going to be spreading in until we can start rolling out vaccinations to that population.
And how about teenagers? I mean, they and children older than 5. What's the vaccination rate for them?
So a lot of teenagers are vaccinated. This does, again, depend from region to region, and it also depends on sometimes local policies, whether or not there's incentives to vaccinate kids, whether they can, you know, participate in sports or school or other activities based on having a vaccine or not. But the rate of kids that are vaccinated, I believe, above the age of 5 is around 50%, so we could still mm-hmm. certainly do a lot better than that.
You want to add to that, Dr. Gounder?
Yeah, the Kaiser Family Foundation, where I work, has been doing polling of parents and their attitudes about vaccination, and we're definitely seeing that parents are, even if they themselves are vaccinated, are less likely to get their adolescents vaccinated and even less likely to get their kids 5 to 11 vaccinated. And I think the message here is, yes, this is necessary. If you compare COVID and the level of disease and death from COVID among kids to other vaccine-preventable diseases, this is a slam dunk. It is clear that we should be vaccinating kids against COVID.
Where's the reluctance, the suspicion coming from?
I think it's a combination of things. I think parents are more hesitant when it comes to children, to their kids, than they might be about their own health. And I think, unfortunately, there's been a lot of mis and disinformation propagated by anti-vaccine conspiracy theorists, which have, unfortunately, influenced some parents' approaches to this, opinions about this.
And how do, as a public health measure, how do you counter that?
It's a great question. What we have seen in kids is pediatricians, a trusted pediatrician is by far the person who is best able to counsel parents, to encourage them to get their kids vaccinated. That can take a lot of time, those conversations. Right. And I think we need to be supporting pediatricians and other clinicians who see kids to do that.
You want to add to that, Dr. Rasmussen?
No, I think that's right on. I mean, studies have shown that people actually do trust health officials and their own physicians and providers first and foremost over anybody else in order to get that information. So I do think that it's absolutely crucial that physicians and especially pediatricians are providing that counseling to encourage parents to understand how the best thing they can do for their kids as far as COVID is concerned is to get them vaccinated.
Here's a question from Rofara, who says, my whole family just got COVID. We are all vaccinated and boosted. Are we protected from the virus for a while? Do we need to mask now that we've recovered? We touched on this earlier, but let me toss this back to you, Angela Rasmussen.
So, as I mentioned, I haven't had COVID, but I have had 4 doses of vaccines. I had the Johnson & Johnson vaccine in the U.S., and then when I moved to Canada, I found out that it was very difficult to transfer my vaccine records, so I had 2 doses of Pfizer to be fully vaccinated here, and then I had a booster in January when that was recommended by my provincial health association. So I'm very vaccinated, fully vaccinated, and very boosted, probably more than many other people. But that said, I always continue to wear a mask when I go grocery shopping, when I'm in public indoor spaces. I continue to wear a mask at work. It's actually still mandated at my work. But I would do that anyways. And I've gone to several conferences, for example. I've worn masks when I'm indoors at those events, at those conference events. I try to do as much as possible outside when I'm with people outside of my household. I continue to take those same measures to avoid getting COVID. And I think that it's a good idea, given that there's so much COVID around, for people to do that regardless of their vaccination or prior infection status. Because the quickest way we can get back to quote-unquote normal lives and not have to worry about this as much is if there's simply less virus circulating in the right communities. And that means that all of us need to do our part to give that virus fewer chances to find a new host and to go on to infect more people.
Do you suggest mixing and matching whatever vaccine people get? If they got, J&J, then they should get to Pfizer. Does that make any sense to do that?
Well, some people have suggested that it does, and I think that the data might suggest that there is some benefit to doing that. Certainly the CDC and the FDA have allowed for people who had Johnson & Johnson to have an mRNA booster dose, but it also may not matter as much as having those additional booster doses. And I will say that the spike protein in all three of these vaccines, Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson, is very, very similar in terms of what it looks like. It's a stabilized prefusion spike protein. It's essentially the same thing that your immune system is responding to in the case of all three vaccines. So I think getting a booster is more important than trying to figure out the ideal mix and match regimen.
Here's a question from Stephen. I'll toss this to you, Dr. Gounder, who says, I read that some people are using the at-home test to swab their throat instead of their nose, and that gives a more accurate result. Would you recommend that? First of all, is that true? Are you better off doing as the instructions say, which is to swab your nose, the inside of your nose?
Yeah, there's been some experimentation by folks at home to try to do this. We do know that Omicron favors the upper respiratory tract in a way that previous variants did not, and that includes the throat as well as the inside of the nose. I'm not sure that I feel like the data is clear enough here to make any strong recommendation one way or another. But I would, at the very least, do one test with sampling from your nose.
Do you agree with that, Dr. Rasmussen?
I do. I say to people, if you want to swab your throat, then go right ahead. Swab your throat, but then swab your nostrils as well with the same swab. And I'd say, ideally, swab your throat first, because you don't really want to stick something in your nose and then stick it in your throat. I'd rather go the other way around.
Well, let me toss out something else, and this is one of the reasons we wanted to do the show, sort of broadly speaking, which was, how do we live with COVID? I mean, it's clear that the virus is still here. It's still circulating. There are still variants. It's very adaptive. To you, Dr. Gounder, so how do we do this? And how long do we have to do this? Is it here to stay?
It is sadly here to stay. We are not going to reach herd immunity with COVID. The biology of the virus simply does not allow that. What we can do is mitigate. We can, in other words, reduce the severity of disease. We can reduce transmission, and some of the tools for reducing transmission include, again, masks and improving indoor air ventilation. And we also can provide better safety nets for people so that we don't see some of the disparities we've been seeing. So making sure everyone has health insurance. Even now, 10% of people in this country don't have health insurance. Mm-hmm. Giving people paid sick and family medical leave so they aren't going to work or sending their kids to school and spreading more virus, they can actually stay home and can afford to do that. So those are the kinds of things we should be doing in order to better adapt to live with COVID.
And to you, Dr. Rasmussen, related, but I've heard and I've felt this from time to time. I'm done with this thing. I am done with this pandemic and this virus. How do we counter that feeling of frustration and exhaustion?
I mean, I completely empathize with that because, boy, I mean, I don't think anybody's probably more done with this virus and this pandemic than those of us who've been working on it nonstop and thinking about nothing but for the last 2.5 years. But unfortunately, the reality is that this virus isn't done with us. So I think we need to be very thoughtful about not asking people to do more than they are able to do. That's why I do try to think about, maybe I'll be wearing a mask for the foreseeable future when I'm in indoor spaces. But that doesn't mean that I'm, wearing a mask constantly and that I'm afraid to leave my house and that, this is completely consuming my entire life. This just means changing the routine things that I do to accommodate something that, when it comes right down to it, really isn't that much of an inconvenience. And I think that trying to frame it differently so that we're not anymore, completely rejiggering our lives around COVID, we're just doing the normal things that we're doing to address this real threat, the same way that we would put on sunscreen, the same way that we would address, you know, influenza by getting a flu vaccine, the same way that we address the threats that we have already been living with, we can start to think about COVID like that. And again, if we all do our part, the more people who contribute in this way by trying to reduce transmission, the quicker we will be able to have this be less intrusive. Because if there's not a whole lot of virus circulating in our communities, we should be able to live lives that were fairly similar to the ones we were living prior to the pandemic happening.
Here's an email for Heidi who says, I'm so confused. I'm 65 years old. My husband is 68, who also has a rare serious autoimmune disorder. We are scheduled for our second booster on Friday. Based on what I'm hearing on the program today, I'm wondering how valuable it will really be. We have not gotten COVID. I'm exhausted with the worry and timing strategy. What is the message? Let me toss that back to you, Dr. Rasmussen. Should they get their boosters on Friday?
They absolutely should get their boosters. Now, so the data on that is pretty clear. A booster shot, a third dose for anybody, does provide a significant benefit in terms of both protection against mortality, hospitalization, and infection, including from Omicron, in everybody. The benefit of a fourth shot is more incremental. But in people like the caller who have high-risk conditions that predispose them to potentially bad outcomes from COVID, that is still a significant boost in protection, especially against hospitalization and mortality. So absolutely get those fourth doses and do continue to take precautions as well. I would also suggest that the caller really not try to worry as much. I think that adds an additional level of anxiety and concern to this. She should rest assured that she's doing everything she can to provide her and her husband with the maximum protection possible. And that is getting a fourth dose, continuing to be careful when you're outside of your house in public spaces.
Heidi, I hope that helps. And I appreciate the email. Let me toss a couple of things to you, Dr. Gounder. We are, you know, weather, summer is coming. It's on the horizon. We have more outside activities. We have more actual activities, going to concerts and going to weddings and going to parties. Anything we should think about in terms of what to do when the weather is warm? And then we'll get to winter.
Well, it all depends on how warm, right? Is it driving you outside or inside?
Right, that's true.
If you're outdoors, your risk of getting COVID are exceedingly small. It's essentially infinite ventilation. So you can rest assured that your risk outdoors is very low. But if you're indoors, if it's really hot, and many of us think this may be part of why we've seen COVID surges in the southern states in the summer, is because it gets so hot, people go indoors. And so the key message here is indoors is much higher risk. Outdoors is exceedingly low risk.
And when we come to winter, I mean, should we sort of prepare as we did for last winter for another surge of infections?
Well, similar sort of pattern, right? So in the northern states of the country where it gets cooler, you're going indoors. So you're going to see more risk at that time of year. In the southern states, you might be actually spending more time outdoors in the fall and winter. But we do anticipate, at least based on the current modeling, that we are in, unfortunately, for another surge this coming fall and winter.
Let me squeeze one more question, and I'll toss it to you, Dr. Rasmussen. I've been reading about this, which is actually quite fascinating, having to do with sewage monitoring. I know that some cities and towns are even doing this. How important is that in 30 seconds or less in terms of understanding infection rates with COVID?
Yeah, I think it's crucially important because as we've stopped doing as many tests, as we've stopped making tests as available to the average person, wastewater actually is one of our only indicators at population level that we may be headed towards a surge. So I hope that more communities do actually implement that.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us, giving us a lot to think about and do. And I appreciate the work that both of you do. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan, Celine Gounder, editor-at-large for public health at Kaiser Health News, and she's an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine and Bellevue Hospital. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. There are lots of programs here that you can listen to. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.